Hi, and welcome to episode 64 of Fresh Out of Tokens podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cyphertier. And somewhere geographically, because I can't tell direction anymore because I'm tired, is my co-host and producer, David, if you would like to say hello.
Hello.
Okay. And listeners, forgive me if I kind of fangirl out this week, because our guest is someone I've been very, very eager to talk with, because I'm a huge Dragon Age nerd, as anyone who's ever talked to me for 5 seconds knows. But we have Jennifer Hepler with us, if you want to say hi.
Hey, everybody. I'm excited to be here, and I love Dragon Age 2, so I'm very happy to talk about it at pretty much any chance I get.
Awesome. So let me get all of our admin stuff out of the way, and then we can jump into questions. So for those who follow the show, either from episode one, or this is your first time listening because of our awesome guests, we have teased and other items in the I Need Diverse Games Spreadshirt shop, where we split the profits 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobinks, and we also have a blog to complement the show over at outoftokenscast.com. If you have questions, compliments, want to be a guest, have episode feedback, or other things to say to us, drop us a line there or at freshouttokens@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter, where we finally broke 1,000 followers, so thank you. You can find us at Out of Tokens Cast, and you can follow David and I, and we'll give you that information at the end of the show. Our musical accompaniment is provided by Mike Moody, and you can hear more of her work at soundcloud.com/MikeMoody-1. And with that out of the way, I know who you are, Jennifer, because I'm a huge nerd, but for those folks listening who may not know you or your work, can you let them know a bit about who you are and what you do?
So I'm Jennifer Brandis Hepler. I am probably best known for having worked at BioWare for 8 years. I was a senior writer on all the Dragon Age games and also on Star Wars The Old Republic. I wrote the second half of the original smuggler storyline for SWTOR, which was a lot of fun. And I was also the lead writer on Game of Thrones Ascent, which was a social mobile strategy RPG based on Game of Thrones that was kind of fun because as a live product, we actually came out on Monday, so you could watch the show Sunday and then play through the episode on Monday, finding out what your character's relationship to what went on in the world in that episode was. So that was kind of fun. And right now I'm working at Cognito, which is a company that uses video game style dialogue to actually train people to have better communication skills and more empathetic conversations. And that's been hugely exciting to me.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. That sounds like the least evil possible use of video game technology.
It's kind of awesome. I found this company sort of randomly, and I was looking at their online demos, and, you know, they have sort of a BioWare-looking dialogue where, you know, you have your options, and you pick something, and then it goes into, you know, an interactive dialogue thing. And I was looking at it and looking at how, oh my God, it's doing everything that I know how to do, except it's doing it in the cause of good, and I want it in, and I've really been loving it.
That's awesome.
So we usually like to ask, what is your gaming origin story? How did you get into gaming?
So really through tabletop gaming. Actually, in my book, I tell the story of my fifth grade teacher actually was Matthew J. Costello, who several years later would go on to write the Seventh Guest game, which sort of broke open CD-ROM gaming. And so back when I was 10 years old and before any of that had happened, he told my parents at the parent-teacher conference, Jennifer needs to find people who play D&D. That's what she needs. Those are her people. And we didn't really think much of it at the time, but then I went to college and ended up joining the science fiction club at Johns Hopkins and getting involved in tabletop role-playing games and just really fell in love with the idea that you could make a group story and use these dice to help tell the story, to create random events that people could react to, and find a way to represent character traits using numbers. And I really, you know, just loved doing the tabletop games. And then my then boyfriend, now husband, and I started going to like Gen Con and some of the big tabletop conventions, and found out that you can really ingratiate yourself with game developers if you're willing to run the Sunday morning 10 a.m. demos after they've been out partying the night before. So as non-partying people, we started doing that and volunteering at conventions and running those early morning demos that nobody wanted to get up for. And eventually that turned into the opportunity to do some writing for tabletop games. And so we did some work for Shadowrun and for Earthdawn and Paranoia and Legend of the Five Rings. And that was really, really fun work, but it paid like birdseed, you know? So we did that for a while until we graduated college and then had to look for something that would actually pay the bills. So we went out to Hollywood for a while and tried to do that. And I was on a TV show called The Agency, which was, I like to describe as the other show about the CIA that came out the same year as 24 and Alias that nobody remembers. And then when it became clear that we did not want to stay in Hollywood and this was a terrible idea, we went to GDC, and my husband happened to be playing KOTOR at the time, and we saw the BioWare booth, which had a big poster of KOTOR up behind it, and I said to him, "Hey, that's that company that made that game you're playing. They look like they use a lot of words." And so we went over, and turned out they were looking to specifically hire people who had some Hollywood experience and looking to hire more women. There were no female writers on staff at the time. And I said, "I can do both of those things." And they were like, "Great, send something." And so then we kind of went back and forth for a few months, both sending in different samples and doing a test assignment, and eventually made the decision to move out of LA and go up to Canada, which was awesome.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. I want to say at some point that Dragon Age 2 is like one of the best written games I've ever played. It's like up there with like Arcanum and
thank you. That's really sweet.
Yeah, I'm gonna stick with Arcanum because it's the
It was a great project to work on. You know, I was just thinking when I was, you know, thinking about what I was going to say on this podcast about how, so we were doing that project under such a tight deadline, and there were definitely some negatives that came from that tight deadline. But I think if we had had more time to work on it, it would have lost some of what I feel makes the writing special. I think there's like a very raw and individual quality to all of the characters because there wasn't a lot of ongoing reviews and navel gazing and homogenizing that you can get if you work on something for too long. And I think that's one of the things that I really love about that game is how strong a voice everybody has, because they weren't, you know, kind of reviewed into one mass, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I still go back and play Dragon Age 2, and I'm lucky enough to be friends with N.K. Jemisin and Meg Giants, and we still flail about these characters. It never fails to suck me in. I can always go back to Kirkwall, and the writing, especially of, you know, like of Fenris, of Anders, of Isabella, is just so stellar that, you know, there's a connection with those characters that I don't really get with games outside of BioWare franchises.
Mm-hmm. I mean, BioWare in general, you know, the followers tend to be very lovingly crafted, and, you know, there's lots of great followers in all the BioWare games, but I really love the Dragon Age 2 followers. You know, I think just they're all really, really distinctive. You know, I love the fact that they had their own lives, and, you know, you could just learn a little bit about what they did when they weren't with you. To me, that was really appealing.
Oh, it was amazing. I don't know if you got a chance to see Meg Giants talk about that this year, actually, at GDC and about NPC agency.
I did. I saw like the last half of it because it was right after my talk, I think. And so I came back in after answering people's questions and came into like a giant screenshot of Anders. And I was like, oh my God, what's going on here? This is very, very confusing at first. But no, I loved her talk and we flailed at each other because 80 Days is one of my favorite games.
Yeah, we've had Meg on the show and she had much, much love for you and for Mike Laidlaw and for BioWare in general.
Yeah, she's great. 80 Days was so much fun. That's really, really one of the best games I've played recently.
Yeah. And because we've, like had Mutual Admiration Society going on, we actually kind of covered the next two questions we had planned for you. Because you already talked about how you got into being a games writer and what you do at Cognito.
I can talk a little more about that if you want. I think we're doing some really cool stuff there. I actually had a project that just came out maybe 2 weeks ago. That was my first project that I worked on for them. And it's a group of short dialogues. I think it's five different, like, five-minute conversations. And it's actually to help low-literacy parents be able to practice positive discipline with their toddlers. So it's the ultimate goal is to give people the tools to be able to stay calm and help their children through difficult situations in order to prevent, you know, ultimately prevent child abuse or prevent negative childhood experiences. You know, so you get to play a parent and you deal with all of these different situations, like your kid having a total meltdown in the supermarket or your kid hits somebody else on the playground. And what do you do about it? And you get to go through and try things. One of the things we do that kind of makes our conversations better than just having the same conversation in real life is that we have a coach feedback that gives you sort of the latest psychological research on what would be effective. So in this case, we were able to share some information on early childhood development and what it really sounds like to a kid if you're yelling at them, you know, and stuff like that. And the project was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and they did like a focus test with some low literacy mothers, and they really found the techniques were helpful, and they went home and they used them with their kids. And, you know, that's just like the most amazing feeling to be using writing and using conversation to help people really make a difference in making their lives better.
Very true. That sounds like something I could have used as a child. But, you know, this is to get in kind of the meat of why we invited you on, aside to flail about Dragon Age on my part. But you've done two really good books, and one of which is sitting on my shelf. It's the Game Narrative Toolbox, and you did that with Toy Finley and LeMay and Tobias Huesner. I hope I said that right.
I think so. I really, like, only corresponded with him by email, I think. So I think it's either Huesner or Huesner. I'm not sure. It's so terribly embarrassing.
That's okay. Tobias, if you hear this, please feel free to correct me. But, you know, this is a really cool toolbox. And actually, one of the conventions I go to, WizCon, and that's more like my home convention, they actually had a game writing workshop with Carrie Young. And I carried that book with me everywhere because, again, I'm a huge nerd. But I was wondering, like, how did this even come about? Because it's not like there's a lot of books like this, at least not that I'm aware of.
So Tobias was actually the one who originally got the project. He and Toya ran, like, the game writers workshop at the Austin GDC for a couple of years before that closed down. And I think they were approached by the publisher who wanted to do a game writing book. Then they were looking for a couple of more people to share it with. And Cameron Harris, who was an editor at BioWare, was one of the people who they asked. And she suggested me. And it happened to kind of fall into my lap right at the time that I was leaving BioWare. And I didn't have anything lined up. So it was a really great project to sort of do during that time where I wasn't committed to full-time writing. And I could dive in and kind of share what I had learned. And so we tried to kind of divvy up the book by genre of game, but mostly we ended up just sort of layering on everybody's opinions on everything. It was sort of a messy project to work on, but I think the finished product is really great, and it has a lot of you know, stuff that you could take 2 years to learn on the job, and we're trying to, you know, help you avoid a lot of those common mistakes that people make in their first couple of years.
Yeah, because even the short amount of time spent with Carrie made me realize I know nothing. So I wish, I'm hoping people use this book, especially, you know, for people that try to go into like game dev programs in college, and or even just use it as a good writing guide.
Well, I know Carnegie Mellon is using it in their curriculum right now for game writing, which is great. And I think there was one other university, but I can't remember which one. Yeah, I'm really hoping it gets picked up there. Warren Spector actually put it on his list of game development books he recommends, which was incredibly flattering. You know, it everything gets outdated pretty quickly, but I think right now we're like the only game writing book that really has pretty strong focus on mobile games. Most of the older game writing books were pre-mobile games, and so they feel very outdated when you read them now. But I think Toya is coming out with another book that's specifically focused on mobile games, so I'm sure ours will get outdated at some point. But the basics about creating good dialogue and creating good story structure should stand the test of time.
Oh, definitely. And David, being someone who's working on his own tabletop game and editing, I'm sure will attest to that, especially with the next question.
Yeah, I will do everything in my power not to say anything disparaging about novelists. But it's so hard. The next question we have is, are there writing skills you would recommend for someone to focus on if they want to get into narrative design specifically?
It kind of depends on the kind of game. If you're going to be doing like a big AAA game, definitely want to focus on dialogue, because that's how the majority of the information that you're going to convey is conveyed. So, you know, you definitely don't want to be big into writing long descriptive paragraphs, you know, if that's what I used to say, and I think I said in the Game Narrative Toolbox, if that's what you like to do as a writer, then games may not be for you. But then 80 Days came out and has fantastic long descriptive paragraphs, and, you know, absolutely use them in an interactive manner. So everything does get outdated, but for big games that have a voiceover budget, you definitely want to work on dialogue stuff. I think writing TV scripts is a fantastic way to get good at dialogue writing, because it makes you have to match the voice of something. So, you know, if you're going on to a big game, it's very likely that you're either going to be coordinating with other writers, or you're going to be working on a sequel and have to match the voice of characters in previous games or stuff like that. So looking at TV shows, which are, you know, very easy and readily available, and you can find scripts for pretty easily, and figuring out how to write that dialogue and write it to the specification you'd need, I think is great practice. Comic books also tend to be relevant for games, because it's that marriage of dialogue and visuals. But if you're doing more of smaller games, you know, more like mobile stuff, then plot becomes a lot more important than dialogue, because you're probably presenting your story in very small snippets. And what you really want to look at is the structure of, you know, what events move the plot along and what the texture of the plot should. I find it particularly not fun to have a plot with no texture, where every event is a big and gigantic event. You know, to me, like, if every scene is up at an 11, then it's the same as if every scene was down at a 3. It just is meaningless, because there's no texture to it. So you really want to get that texture and pacing down in a smaller game where you have less space to tell the story.
Okay.
Is that too technical?
Oh, no, not for me. I write a lot, and I've got a degree in usability, so that makes total sense to me. And I'm sure if our listeners have questions, they will go, hey, that was technical, please explain. but speaking of stories, I had the pleasure and the chance to review your newest book project, which is Women in Game Development, Breaking the Glass Level Cap. You know, I got a chance to read it and review it, and that's how we started chatting about other stuff. Now, you eventually wound up on the show. But for those people that may not have read it yet, well, one, kind of what prompted you to gather these women's stories? Because a lot of them were women, you know, that if we say their names, people will recognize them. And then there are some people who, you know, are very new to the industry and may or may not be as well known. So I was wondering kind of what prompted that, and was there any kind of catalytic moment for those that may not have read the book that prompted this collaboration?
So I proposed this book, Women in Game Development, Breaking the Glass Level Cap, right around when the Game Narrative Toolbox was just wrapping up, and I wanted to follow up and do another project that I would be kind of taking the helm of. And it was right as Gamergate was happening, and that was, you know, obviously a big, huge news topic that got outside of just the game industry and was making mainstream news, and a lot of people were interested in exploring it. And so I proposed to Focal Press that we would do a book kind of loosely patterned off of a book that the Writers Guild of America had released in the early 2000s called The First Time I Got Paid for It, which was a collection of a few dozen screenwriters talking about their first sale as professional writers. And I always found that an interesting format of, here's a lot of people who are sort of the uncelebrated people in Hollywood doing the work that, you know, is the work that everyone thinks they can do. And how did they actually go about doing it? And so I thought, you know, we should do that for gaming, except we should make it about the experiences of women in games. And because gaming is such a complicated field, we should have a couple of people from every specialty. So we should have a few programmers, a few artists, a few writers, a few designers. I wanted to make sure to include community management because I think that's a very underappreciated aspect of game development. And so I proposed this to Focal. And I also suggested that since they're primarily a textbook publisher, that in between the essays, I would include some chapters talking about kind of what it takes to break in each of those fields, and what are the obstacles that you might face as a woman in those fields. And if you already work in the game industry in those fields, what are some things that you could maybe do to make your field more inclusive? And so Focal pretty much agreed immediately. They gave me, you know, exactly the book I wanted. I don't think I got one note from them in the entire process. And so I started reaching out, and I had, you know, maybe a third of the people, not even, you know, a handful of the people in the book were people who I specifically wanted because they had a unique perspective. Like, I wanted Brenda Romero because she's the longest working woman in games. And I wanted Anita Sarkeesian and Brianna Wu as some of the faces of the victims of Gamergate. And I wanted Erin Hoffman, who was EA Spouse back in the day. I think a lot of people may have heard of EA Spouse, but don't know that Erin is a game designer in her own right. And so I wanted to include her. And then after that, I reached out to some different Women in Games Facebook groups and the IGDA and just kind of asked for submissions and went through and tried to, you know, make those quotas of, I wanted to get, you know, at least two people from each field we'd be covering. And then I wanted to make sure that we had an essay, at least, that every person reading it could relate to. So, you know, I looked at kind of, you know, the making sure that we had a good diversity of people ethnically, and reached out to some people. And I found some great people by specifically looking to expand the diversity in the book. Charisma Williams was somebody who I didn't know at all before starting work on the book. And I reached out to her after finding an interview with her as a, you know, as an African-American woman working in games. And she has one of my favorite essays in the book. And I think that she and Elizabeth LaPensee, who is a Native American game developer, you know, really bring just a really different perspective than the book would have had if I just went with the people who initially sent me submissions.
Yeah, because there were so many people, both familiar and unfamiliar, and it was just amazing to see, like, someone close to the age I am now, that's when she got into games.
Yeah, I really wanted to have a good range of ages. I wanted to have people like, you know, Brenda, who had been in the industry forever, but I also wanted some, you know, up-and-coming people. I wanted, you know, a couple of people who just really, you know, were kind of representative of the everywoman experience in gaming. Like Kari Toyama, I don't think is a widely known name, and she just, you know, had an experience of she was a competitive Halo player and then ended up going on QA at Bungie, and now she's worked up to being a producer. I don't think she's at Bungie anymore now. I'm forgetting where she went to. I think to PopCap. But it was great to just read, you know, even the stories of people who you would think, you know, may not have that dramatic a story. Everybody's stories were really fascinating. Everybody worked really hard to get where they are.
Oh, they did. It makes me really happy. And I'm very glad that I got a chance to read and review the book.
Yeah, I'm really happy you got to review it also.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I guess we want to know, what was your favorite essay out of the book? Do you have one?
I have four.
Ooh.
I love Aaron Hoffman and Elizabeth Sampat's essays. Aaron Hoffman's was an amazing sort of look at her journey from being the tomboy and being the aggressive nerd who, you know, wasn't into feminism and, you know, didn't want to be identified as female and didn't want to be involved with any gender politics, and her journey to sort of realizing, wait a minute, you know, if I'm accepting that there are not a lot of women in nerd culture, and I think nerd culture is all about being smart, and I know women are as smart as men, why are there not more women in nerd culture? And just sort of unpacking all of that, I thought was an incredibly powerful essay. And Elizabeth Sampat did a fabulous essay on why she's so grateful to games and to everything she's gotten through being in the games industry, and yet she's often called ungrateful online for wanting to change it, but she believes we have a responsibility to the things we love, even if they don't always love us back, which I thought was a fabulous quote. And then, like I mentioned, Charisma's essay just really, really blew me away because she just has such incredible confidence in herself that it was really fun to read about her experiences. And then Lee Alexander also wrote a fabulous essay on kind of starting in games journalism and what games journalism has meant and why she thinks it can be something so much more than just talking about, you know, how is the graphics engine on this game working, and, you know, is it challenging enough, and can we really question games as an art form, and the flack she took for that in Gamergate.
Mm-hmm. Lee is amazing, and I'm forever grateful to her and Offworld for giving me a chance to write.
Yeah, she's fabulous. So those are my four favorite essays in the book, and now I feel like, you know, the world's worst classroom teacher who's playing favorites. But that's why I stopped being a classroom teacher. I was really bad at not playing favorites.
You know, everyone has that one or four essays that just really touch them, and, you know, that's why I was just so enthusiastic about it, especially for people who may not even be into gaming to read it. Because I think if you're not into gaming, not into gaming culture in some aspect, it can seem like a total foreign entity to you.
And yet the weird thing is that as women in any sort of business world, people, I think, relate to it. I've given a copy to my aunt who was like an accountant who broke into like the big five accounting firms in the 70s when they were all male, and she totally related to, you know, the situations that people have gone through in trying to break that glass level cap. And one of my producers at work was just telling me today that a friend of hers who is at an ad agency is reading it in her book club with her friends at the ad agency, because what they go through as women in a creative field is really similar, you know. So I think that's sort of one thing that the Hillary Clinton campaign has showed, is that, you know, women who are working in male-dominated fields all kind of have the same experiences. It doesn't matter what the field is.
Yeah, because I've got a computer science background, and I'm usually alone. Well, you know, I wasn't the only person to review the book. So I was wondering, what's been kind of your feedback to the book now that it's out and about in the world?
Well, initially the biggest feedback was that it was overpriced, but luckily CRC dropped the price recently. So anybody who's listening wants to pick it up. It is now much more reasonably priced. And other than that, the feedback's been incredibly positive. I think that a lot of women are reading it and really relating to it. And some of them are reaching out. They're getting men in the field to read it. There's one person who I know a little bit through a Facebook group, and she read it and loved it so much that she took orders and made a bulk order for all of the leadership team at Volition. And so there's, you know, like a dozen or more people in the company reading it now, and they're really trying to make some changes in their work culture as a result of it. So I think that that's fabulous. I would love to see that happening.
Oh, wow. That is really impressive.
It's one thing I learned in doing that book is that the women who work in games are who you want on your team. Like, they all had to work really hard to get into, you know, a field where they didn't get automatically assumed to be competent, and so they're all such driven, type A, incredibly accomplished people that I just read every single essay, and I was like, I think I want to make a game company and just hire everyone in this book, and we will make, like, the best games ever.
Please do that.
We also wanted to ask, is there anything exciting coming up that you want to talk about? Or that you can talk about. Sometimes people can't.
I mean, I'm working on, you know, a bunch of projects for Cognito, but those are, you know, not all that game related, really. I'm doing several different simulations to help pediatricians talk with patients about different things, from childhood obesity to performance enhancement drugs. And I'm working on something right now that I'm really loving that is to help military caregivers be able to learn how to sort of ask for help and advocate for themselves because caregiving is such a difficult, thankless task. So that's pretty close to my heart. My only commercial game thing that I have coming out is I did some work with Wajidai Games, designing the story for their upcoming game, The Unavowed. And that's going to be fun. That's an adventure game that you play a character who got possessed by a demon, and while you were possessed, you went on this incredible crime spree through all of New York, and then after the demon is exorcised out of you, you join up with the people who did the exorcism, and you go try to track down what the demon made you do, and basically solve all the crimes that you committed. So that was a lot of fun to write that story.
It sounds like fun.
That's awesome. I will
look forward to that.
It's not out yet, but I'm not sure when it's coming out, but they've been tweeting some screenshots and stuff, and it looks really cool. It's very, you know, it's sort of a combination of like a role-playing game and an adventure game. So it's going to be adventure game style gameplay, but you're going to have a party like in BioWare with followers who you can have different conversations with at your base and stuff like that. So I think it's going to be really fun to kind of have that aspect of a BioWare game without needing to have all of the baggage that you have in role-playing games of them being difficult for a new audience. You know, I think this will be a little easier maybe for people to get into.
Cool. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye out for it. So we got through some questions, and then the fun part of the show is usually when listeners send in questions, and I'm excited because it was just really fun to see you and Nora interacting on Twitter because, it's weird because, like, I've known Nora for such a long time, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. People, like, have this, oh my god, you know Nora Jemison thing.
Yep.
But then it's like seeing the two of you, like, squee at each other, it was so cute.
I was really, really excited that that she likes my work, because I think she is just fantastic. I had actually just finished the fifth season like a day before that, so I was riding the high from it still.
Awesome. And The Obelisk Gate is out, so.
I know, I'm excited.
Yeah, I have my copy sitting next to me. I'm going to be good and not touch it till I'm on the plane, because otherwise I won't sleep today. But Nora actually has some questions for you, and I may throw in kind of a question because it's a fangirl question, and I'm like, let's see where this goes. But her first question was, were you consciously interrogating terrorism in the construction of Anders?
Absolutely. Let me see, where to begin with this one? So Anders was, I was actually on Star Wars The Old Republic when Dragon Age 2's initial outline was written. And so the concept of that Anders was going to merge with Justice and commit a terrorist act was handed to me. That was something that Dave Gator and Mike Laidlaw had come up with. And I really wanted to do a like a cursed Buffy and Angel kind of romance, because as a player, I was really feeling that lack in any of the other BioWare games. All the romances tended to have very leading man types as the people you romanced, you know, and people like Karth just didn't do it for me. I really wanted a, you know, dark and broody guy. And so they said, well, we're planning to do this thing where Anders merges with Justice. Why don't you take that on? And so I was looking at it and looking at Anders from Awakening, who is kind of this happy-go-lucky hedonist. And I'm thinking, how do I get him from there to I'm a terrorist? And so I was thinking a lot about how people become radicalized. And I really wanted to kind of show his whole process from going from someone who's just angry about injustice to someone who was really willing to kill innocent people to make his point. And so that was a really interesting thing to get to do because of Dragon Age 2's format with the time jumps, that you could really kind of see him go from, you know, the first act of the game, he's merged with Justice, he's trying to control the demonic side, and he wants to make things better, but he's still kind of thinking on a personal level. And then you get all the way up through Act 3, where he's suicidal, he's showing a lot of signs, he's giving away personal possessions, and, you know, he's writing his manifesto, and you're seeing all of these warning signs that are really the warning signs that you see when people become radicalized. And so I wanted to, you know, to explore the fact that he both has a legitimate grievance that the mages are treated poorly, and yet he chooses a terrible solution to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't have, obviously, any answers on, like, how to fix terrorism, but it was certainly, you know, I was very consciously looking at that question. And then it was really disturbing a few months later when Anders Breivik in Norway committed a terrorist act. And it was, you know, just sort of like seeing, you know, the worst of my character come to life. And I got really a little chilled by that coincidence and decided I don't think I want to write any more sympathetic terrorist characters.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to ask, and this is just strictly more of a, it's a fan-ish question, but it's also just literally like, how did this work? Because if you look at the timeline, it seems like Anders is in Kirkwall when he should have still been a warden, unless, like, I'm reading things wrong, because that was one of the things that people always just kind of bring up of, if you look at, like, how the two games kind of meet, it seems like Anders would have still been a warden slash you do have the option of a quote-unquote happy ending where he stayed with the wardens.
Yeah. There weren't any conditionals put on those endings in Awakening, so there wasn't any way for us to know what ending a player had gotten. So there wasn't really a technical way to honor those little epilogue endings in Origins and Awakening, and so we didn't.
Oh, okay. Well, that, hey, well, that's an easy answer.
To put it bluntly.
I never noticed, because Anders does show up after after Hawk, so I it was always sort of vague to me how much time the gameplay represents.
Well, Anders is supposed to have been there.
Yeah, he arrives shortly before Hawk. He's also with the wave of Ferelden refugees.
It must just be the order in which I did stuff.
I can tell you my my favorite rejected BioWare proposal that I ever did, which is that I really wanted... Because we get a lot of people always complaining that, you know, well, I wouldn't do what a demon is tempting me with because they don't actually live in that world and there's nothing we can really tempt them with that is worth it. And I really wanted to do something where in the first piece of DLC after Dragon Age 2, that Justice walks into town still wearing the body from Awakening and says, what do you mean merging with Anders? I never merged with Anders. And you realize that he just was tricked by a demon because they're that tricky. They're that tricky that you could believe in them for an entire game and not realize that they were tricking you. But sadly, that was not to be.
Oh my God, that would have been so amazing.
That's my headcanon of it.
Another question we got from N.K. Jemison is, were you consciously interrogating the willingness of authorities to benefit from oppression?
You know, it was interesting because when I first wrote Elthena, kind of, I was in the Anders mindset, and it, definitely we were looking at that even though she never did anything wrong, she, you know, was not willing to stand up and make changes, and therefore she was complicit in what was happening. And then later I wrote Sebastian and kind of, you know, got more in her point of view of it. And so I think it's really interesting because, again, it's not a simple thing. I think she genuinely wanted to be peaceful and, you know, wanted to find a peaceful solution to something that there may not have been a peaceful solution to. So does that make her complicit? We kind of wanted that to be something that people could still be debating here 5 years later. But yeah, you know, we definitely were consciously looking at, you know, did Elthena bear some responsibility for not intervening and not not doing something to deal with the growing tensions that were obvious in the city?
It's just so interesting because at some point I keep wanting to go, okay, fine, the mages are right, or the Templars are right, or I'm going to elect a Viscount, and it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, but it would be very hard to do either of those things.
Right.
You know, the overarching theme that we were working with on the whole game was freedom versus security. And, you know, that was something that was just told from the very beginning of the game. This is what we want to be exploring. And it's a fascinating question because it's very real and it's very modern and it's very universal of how many freedoms are you willing to give up in order to be safe? And people, when they're playing a game, always feel like, nothing, I would give up no freedoms in order to be safe. I don't care about safety. And yet, probably those same people, you know, are not going to be that cavalier in real life. It's one of the things, you know, writing the mages, they really are dangerous. Like, we created a situation where it's not just crazy, out of proportion public response. They really are dangerous. And there is some responsibility for keeping that danger away from the public. But obviously, the way the Templars do it ends up being abusive because, you know, when you give people ultimate authority over other people and dehumanize them, it's always going to be abusive. And so, you know, it was meant to be a really genuinely thorny question. And, you know, one of the ways I like to describe it is that, you know, blood magic for mages in Dragon Age is kind of like piracy for PC gamers. Everybody sort of knows that it's wrong, and most people pay some lip service to not doing it. But ultimately, if they're up against the wall and they want something bad enough, they always know it's an option. And, you know, that's kind of creepy when somebody, you know, has the ability to obliterate you, and it's always an option. You know, how many people really have the self-control to not use that option ever in the course of a lifetime? I don't think it's that many. So, you know, some people found it really unrealistic how many blood mages there were in Kirkwall, but I don't really think it would be that unusual. It's kind of what mages do. It's what mages do when they let down, and everybody lets down sometimes.
I mean, and Kirkwall was a hellmouth. If I lived there, I probably would use blood magic. I'm sorry, y'all.
Yeah.
I do feel like the gameplay really ties into that, because if you play a blood mage, you are so overpowered in Dragon Age 2.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate, and I'm not sure if Inquisition did this, but we always wanted to really be able to have the world react to you differently if you were a blood mage, and that was always sort of something that ended up on the cutting room floor because of, you know, budget and time constraints. So the gameplay never reflected, you know, exactly what we wanted of blood mages in the world, but, you know, it certainly, there was nobody who played a blood mage and then chose not to use the blood magic.
True.
I used to joke with a friend that, like, the third wave of guys in any, when you're playing a blood mage, must be questioning their stabbing you plan when that's one of your most powerful attacks.
Yeah.
True. Now, this is a question, and it's not a question that anyone sent in, but is it possible, because this is a point of debate between me and other people in fandom, if you are a blood mage, does it affect also healing? So, like, Anders could be a blood mage in Awakenings, but then it's almost like, hey, you can't do blood magic and heal later on in the series. At least that's the way it comes off.
I think that's another one of those things where we didn't have the ability to track things like what class you made your character, and the writers were always a little at war with the game designers over whether you should be allowed to be a blood mage, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the lore that the player should ever be a blood mage, but it's something that people enjoy doing in the gameplay. So that was, I would say, one of those things that's just a little inconsistent.
Okay. Yay. An answer. But, you know,
sometimes that's the answer in game development.
As I'm learning. But, you know, since we're talking about mages and Templars, one of Nora's other questions was, does the quote-unquote resolution to the Mage-Templar War in Inquisition fit your original intent? And she said she's totally fine with a yes-no answer.
So, I have to say, I haven't actually played Inquisition. It was very painful for me leaving BioWare in the middle of that project, and I kind of didn't want to see what it ended up as, because I'd like to keep it the way I remember it. So I'm not sure what the published version of it ended up being, but I thought that the chance for the player to decide what to do with the Chantry going forward was an excellent way to end Inquisition. And, you know, I think that that certainly was something that fans have wanted to have the chance to do, is, you know, say what they want to say about religion in the game and just have everybody listen to them.
Very cool. And then David has the next question, but just for those listening, you and Nora kind of talked about it on Twitter, but, you know, for the sake of people who may not have seen that Twitter exchange, and also this episode is being recorded even a week after you all were chatting on Twitter, I just wanted to still throw the question in there. So, David, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Nora's last question was, do you have any non-game prose work out there? And if so, where?
Sadly, no. I have some terrible repetitive stress injuries, so I really can't do personal projects. I need to save my hands for my paying work, so I don't have any novels or anything out at this time. Maybe at some point in the future.
Hopefully repetitive stress injuries will get better, because I'm sure whatever you write will be amazing.
I do have an idea for a book that I would really like to do, but I think I have no idea when I would be able to do it.
Hopefully it can come to fruition one way or another.
Thanks.
So the next two questions are awesome because Anna McGill is just awesome. And so I'm going to reuse the word awesome because she asked, A, how are you so awesome? And then follow-up question, how do you stay so awesome?
I saw those. I have no idea how to answer that. I think that will officially be my answer.
That's fair. So see there, Anna, that is your question. And our next set of questions is from my friend Aaron, who may be the bigger BioWare nerd between us. I don't know. He and I will have to fight over this when I have him on the show next week. David, do you want to take his first two questions?
Sure. So, the first question he asks is, who was your favorite character to write for, and who was your favorite character that you didn't write for?
Anders was my favorite to write. I think I actually had like a manic episode when writing him in his frenzied Act 3 stuff. I've never had a writing experience like that before or since. I couldn't stop writing him. I would literally be at a red light in the car and have to pick up a piece of paper and jot down dialogue because it was just like it had taken me over. I really loved writing Anders. He was very close to my heart, and I can't remember his voice actor's name anymore, but he did an amazing job with him, and it was just, he was a great experience, start to finish. My favorite character who I just loved playing with was Fenris, and it was sort of ironic that I wanted to do the dark, broody romance because BioWare had never done it. And then on the same game, Dave Gator also wrote one, but it was really fun to play one that I didn't write and still have it be very much the dark, broody, guy. So I really enjoyed him. I think he and Anders are great foils for each other because they're so incredibly similar, but yet have completely different... They're like, the opposite ends of the political spectrum, but exactly the same personality. Uh-huh. And that was really kind of fun.
That just made me so incredibly happy to hear you say that.
And his second question is, what are you currently reading?
What am I currently reading? This week I am reading Kate Elliott's Black Wolves, which is very cool. I think that's out fairly recently, but I'm a big fan of a lot of Kate Elliott's work, and so I'm reading that. I read a lot of historical fiction also, especially when I was working on Game of Thrones. I read a ton of Philippa Gregory and Elizabeth Chadwick and all the, kind of people who are writing up historical novelizations of real kings and queens, because I had to write 52 weeks of Game of Thrones a year, and most of the, only 10 weeks of that was covered by the show, and the rest of the time I was writing original Westeros material, so I needed a lot of historical background to keep coming up with things that people could do to each other that were horrible enough.
Okay. I have not played Game of Thrones, mostly just because I haven't read the books or watched the show because I got rid of cable. So I feel like I don't know what's going on at all.
Yeah, you're probably not the target audience for it then.
I could play it, but I'd just be like, who are these people? What's going on?
You would end up liking the parts that are, you know, the original storyline more than the stuff where you deal with the book and show characters, because we don't explain much about who they are. We kind of assume that you know who you're talking to.
Okay, then.
But I did get to do 2 full years of original storyline on Game of Thrones Ascent, and so I got to write professional Game of Thrones fan fiction, so that was exciting.
That's amazing. I think that's kind of my not-so-secret reason I kind of want to do games writing.
It's really fun getting to play. I love shared worlds. Like, that's why when I was doing Hollywood, what I was interested in was TV. I never really wanted to write movies. They're too standalone for me. But I loved writing spec scripts for, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And, you know, how do we get into these characters who we love and tell an original story with those characters, with those situations in that world? Like, that's what I love doing. I'm not as fond of doing purely original work. I really, really like working in shared universes.
And then Aaron's last question, and I swear we do not have like 10 million questions for you. I did cut people off at a certain point. Well, this is probably the most questions we've got for guests, I think, in like ever. But his last question was, when writing characters, how do you find a voice for them? Do you look at designs for the character, or do you read a description, and what is your technique?
Let me think about that. That's such an intuitive thing, the voice for them. I don't have a huge technique for that. I kind of, you know, I've always thought of my writing as being kind of painterly. Like, I do a very quick, rough first draft, and I compare it to like a color study. You know, if you've ever seen where a painter doesn't actually paint the figures but just uses all the colors that will be in the final picture, and you know, and then out of that usually emerges, you know, a voice that I think feels right for the character. And then after that, that's sort of the internal meter against which I measure future writings to say, does that sound like this character? You know, it's largely a what feels right. Like, I'm a very, very auditory person, and so I read my work out loud, and I think, you know, does this sound right? Is this what I want the character to sound like? And so I guess that's my biggest technique, is I do a lot of reading out loud. I work from home now, which makes that so much easier than when I'm in an office setting. So I do a lot of reading everything out loud and really, you know, trying to eliminate any words that you stumble over and just get it so that it's going to be the best audio experience it can be.
Yeah, because reading words out loud versus, like, the first time you see them, and then when you try it again, it's very interesting how the tone and whatnot can come up as you're reading it out loud, and then you go, oh, that actually makes perfect sense. I did it, yay.
Yep.
So one of Tim's 2 questions was, what kind of good can games/interactive media be used for if we stop insisting that they quote unquote just be games?
Well, I think that's one of the things that that we're doing at Cognito, and I did a talk at Games for Change this year where I really talked about, you know, I think that even in BioWare games where we are, you know, really trying to do good work and, you know, to explore difficult themes and stuff, the way that games are structured, where it's always about trying to give the player agency and make the player feel like their actions are what make everything happen. I feel like it sort of inadvertently is training people to feel like that's how conversations should work, that if they're doing it right, they should speak and everything else should be a reaction to them. And that's like the opposite of how real conversations work. Real conversations the least important aspect of them is knowing what you want to say. Really, 90% of the work is listening to the other person and figuring out how to get them to hear what you want them to hear. And so I feel like by stepping away from that sense of player agency and going into, you know, teaching people how to listen and how to look at their own words from the point of view of the person who's hearing them, we're able to really create game-like situations that really help people have better communication skills. And I think at Games for Change, there were all kinds of different people who were using game technology or actual games to try to address a variety of good causes. And, you know, I think that you mentioned Meg's talk at GDC. There was a huge theme at GDC this year of, you know, we're past the player. You know, let's talk about something other than how to make the player happy. And let's see what else we can do. And I think that that's really the crucial thing, because if it's just about how do you make the person playing the game feel constantly satisfied, what are you teaching people? You know, you're teaching them that they should feel constantly satisfied, and that's not how life works.
Exactly. And then David?
Yeah.
No, I was just wondering if you had thoughts on that, because we've had off and on discussions about kind of, you know, just interactive media and how the player doesn't always have to get their way, which is what I love about 80 Days.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know if you had thoughts, David, before we move on to the last question.
Like, I remember years ago in, like, you know, like Fallout 2 and Arcanum, when you would approach dialogue in a game, it was really easy to make the wrong choice if you weren't paying attention to the way they were set up. Like, the phrasing they were using and so on. And it does feel like some of that has, like, been lost, like, in the same series, like Fallout 4, the current dialogue system comes down to yes, no, and sarcastic. Yeah,
and that's very easy to do. You know, it's in working on Cognito simulations where it's really all about listening closely to the other person and understanding really what the difference is between, say, saying the same thing as a statement and asking it as a question. And, you know, like in one of our sims for pediatricians, we are looking at, you know, asking the question of, you know, you find it hard to avoid sugary snacks, compared to the empathetic statement of, it can be really hard to avoid sugary snacks. And, you know, just even though those are basically the same words, they're entirely different in what the person is hearing. And, you know, to be able to show things like that, we really can't use a dialogue tree structure because the conversation has to be a lot more reactive than we ever could be in a commercial game. And so, you know, we're putting out a single conversation at a time, not a whole big gigantic storyline. And so we can really handcraft the responses and make sure it feels more like a conversation in real life.
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant, and a better explanation than I could have come up with right now. there were places in, like, those old isometric RPGs where you'd be in a conversation tree and you'd run into an area where you just have the four options of this same basic thing phrased differently, and you have to, like, know where the person you're talking to is at.
Mm-hmm.
And what they'll respond to based on the conversation previously. And,
you know,
we don't really do that anymore.
You know, back when everything was just text, it was a lot cheaper to include lots of different options. And that was something that, you know, was very much debated at BioWare, especially in the transition from Origins to Dragon Age 2, of, you know, does what we gain from being able to voice the player options make up for what we lose in not being able to list 15 different ways, you know, that we want to have you approach it? And ultimately, I think that it you know, having the voiced player really does bring those characters to life. Like, to me, Hawk is much more of a character than my warden ever was. But it does definitely, you know, mean you have a lot fewer options, and it's, you know, there are points where budgetarily it's just not worth it to offer an option based on this fringe case and stuff like that.
Yeah. Because it's so weird to go back and play Origins, and you're like, oh, wait, no one's talking. What's going on?
Yeah, I always felt it was, like, bizarre that, you know, not only were you not talking, but because you weren't talking, you had no facial expressions. And so, like, these big, important conversations were going on around you, and you were just sort of looking blankly at the wall, like, ribbit, you know? And it was just like, I don't know, I always felt there was something a little wrong with my warden.
Well, the warden's seen some shit by the time you make those decisions. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I was a dwarf commoner, so, you know, she probably didn't have great childhood nutrition or anything.
Yeah.
A little dwarven lead poisoning.
BioWare definitely navigated that change better than Bethesda, because Dragon Age 2 at least specified if sarcastic was a yes or a no.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim's other question is, what project are you proudest to have worked on?
I mean, I think I'm proudest of the work I'm doing now with Cognito, because it is really... It helps me get through, you know, just waking up and all of the horror that is in the news, to know, you know, I'm working somewhere where we are trying to make a difference and trying to address things. We have a simulation coming out shortly that is actually helping law enforcement use trauma-informed policing dealing with Native American youth, and we're hoping that that will be sort of a trial project for eventually doing, you know, empathy building and you know, simulations about trauma-informed policing that could be used more broadly. And knowing that I'm working at a place that might be able to offer some help to horrible situations in the world is, you know, just so incredibly validating. But I'm also really proud of Dragon Age 2.
That's so awesome. And I got a chance to tell Dave Gator, and I will tell you, Dragon Age 2 is my favorite game of all time.
That's awesome. It's, like, amazing. I've heard a lot of people say that, you know. It's one of those games that every time there was a, like, a poll on the BioWare forums of which is better, Origins or Dragon Age 2, it was always posted by somebody thinking Origins was going to win in a landslide. It always came out dead even. And, you know, the difference was that most of the people who loved Dragon Age 2 also loved Origins. They just loved 2 a little more, whereas the people who picked Origins were loved Origins and hated Dragon Age 2. So, but there's a lot of people who really did love it and, you know, and still are talking about it. And I love that the questions that it raises, you know, are things that still can be talked about 5 years later, and, you know, the themes and everything are still really relevant, and what people are talking about, you know, are the things that we wanted you to be thinking about terrorism, about, you know, are the authorities complicit when they turn a blind eye, and, you know, the fact that people are still wrestling with those questions from that game this much later is just awesome.
Yeah, I will link you later, but you know, Dragon Age 2, and I'm trying to think, Inquisition was out when I wrote my piece for Offworld, and, you know, the fact that one game, or a series of 3 games, can bring so much dialogue and meta and just fandom, for the most part, I admit this, and I know people will yell at me, I don't care, but for the most part, Dragon Age fandom can be good. I've made some wonderful friends, but on most days, ending in Y, it's a trash fire, because people cannot... there cannot be a civil dialogue or dialect when it comes to things, because people are so passionate about the games, I think.
Mm-hmm. And because they have such a sense of ownership, you know, BioWare games, people get so personal because it's, you know, it's not just Origins, it's their warden and it's their shepherd, and they have this, you know, such a sense of ownership that, you know, we want to create, we want to let you create your own story. That's the point of RPGs. But, you know, ultimately, not everybody's story can be the story. And you have to be okay with the fact that your headcanon is in your head and somebody else's headcanon may look different.
Yeah, if fandom could learn that, I would actually actively participate again. But that's a whole, that's a conversation for well after this podcast, or if I get to see you in person. But we're almost out of time, but what we'd like to do to end the show is to kind of talk about what we're playing, slash reading, or watching. And since you are our esteemed and honored guest, you get to go first.
The two games that I'm kind of in the middle of right now are Her Story and 1979 Revolution. Those were both games where I heard the creators speak either at GDC or at Games for Change and was just fascinated and wanted to pick up the game and see what it was all about.
Okay, I'm interested in how Her Story goes for you, because like I said, I watched a lot of streams of it. I thought about trying it, and it just didn't seem like it was kind of my jam. So, like, I'm not trying to be that curmudgeon. It's like, oh, everyone likes it. I don't like it because I'm a hipster. It's just I literally, like, something's not clicking for me with the game.
You know, I enjoyed it. It's interesting because it's a very different kind of gameplay, and I'm kind of like a Law & Order junkie. I've watched a ridiculous amount of Law & Order and Law & Order SVU, so, you know, dealing with the police procedural and the language of that is, you know, really accessible and made it easy to get into the story for me.
Okay. Huh. I'm going to have to give it another shot once I'm done traveling for the fall. David, what are you up to?
I haven't really been doing much. I have actually still been, like, messing around with Starbound, because it's just one of those procedurally generated things that goes on forever. But I've also been playing Fallout Shelter occasionally, and I sort of, like, broke the game. I ended up with one of my dwellers being in the bedroom, like, in the dormitory, and also exploring. Like, when you tap on the guy who's standing there, it would bring up the window you'd look at to see what your explorers are up to. And it was really weird. He was just in like two places at once for a few days.
That's an impressive bug.
If like the room got set on fire, he'd put out the fire, and if someone of the opposite gender was in the room, he'd hang out and reproduce.
That's a mechanic that still bugs me about Fallout Shelter. It's like, I looked away for 2 minutes, and now there are babies.
Yeah, it incentivizes babies in a way that's sort of slimy.
There's no sort of it is slimy. And then I've actually been playing Moon Hunters from Kid Fox Studios. It is a 1-4 player RPG that's cooperative, and find a friend. If you're playing this on PC, you can do co-op. If you are playing on PS4, right now the co-op does not work. But you need at least one other person to beat the final boss. It's really cool. And it's difficult, but hopefully, knock on wood, by the time you are hearing this, listener, my article on it will be out in Vice. And also Fossil Echo, which is a new game out. It is very bright and colorful. The music score is amazing. I got to meet the gentleman who did the score at BitBash Chicago. So, it's a good game. It's only been out a month. Please go check it out on Steam. It's only $15.
Oh my goodness. My kids are back. So I think I'm going to need to get going.
Okay. That's okay. Just really quick before you have to go, where can folks find you online?
On Twitter, you can find me at JB Hepler, and, my Facebook I keep private, so Twitter's probably the best place to look for me. Thank you for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Jennifer. Have a wonderful night.
Thanks, you too.
Alrighty. And David, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at RedConversation and at DavidLReeves.com. I'm working with new writers again, so if you're working on anything and you need some, like, manuscript evaluation or anything, really.
Okay. And I'm Cypher of Tear pretty much everywhere. We may miss a week when you are hearing this because of the upcoming holiday. So if we take a week off, we'll see you in 14 days because I'm going hither and yon all over God's country. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 1 to 2 weeks. Thank you and have a good night. Thank you.